You know, there's been so much conversation this spring about the uniforms, and I don't really know that much about the pants. You can probably speak to that better. All I know is that the jerseys...
You're telling me I can talk about sheer pants better than you? Well,
what's up, baseball fans? Welcome to another episode of Put Me in Coach, a podcast about the great sport of baseball. My name is Matt Coggins.
And my name is Carl Mizell. And I feel it's important now that we are on YouTube, you can actually see what we look like on YouTube. I feel it's important to point out that I'm wearing a Philadelphia Phillies shirt. I lived there for almost 2 years. So I come by it honest. I'd call them not quite a B team, but like a C team. Like, I keep an eye on them. I love, you know, Castellanos and Schwabe and Hoppe. I love saying names like that with Boston accents.
I have rooted for them the past couple postseasons. I'll say that.
Yeah. They're easy to root for.
Carl, we are talking about a hell of a topic today because baseball fans might know that there's a handful of free agents that are still unsigned. And one of the big names just took a contract this week that many are calling whelming. Not quite underwhelming, whelming. Not the huge contract he wanted. We're talking about Cody Bellinger, but also not the not exactly a snub. It's something that he'll probably build on for next year. But that led us to come up with the idea of talking about free agency, what it is, what it means, where it comes from, and why this has happened as we're already talking spring training. Yeah. But I did want to ask you, how you been?
I've been great, man. I was traveling a lot for work last week in the state. And by the state, I mean in the state of Michigan where I'm from. But I was in Detroit for a week visiting clients and going to a conference. So picking this extremely broad topic for me to handle the script on was a bad idea on my part. It was 72 degrees here in Michigan. It is February 27th, the year of our Lord, 2024. Tomorrow's going to be 44, and we're expecting some pretty gnarly storms overnight. So I'll keep you in mind, former Michigan resident, as I'm doing my dadly duty and standing out in the front porch looking for funnel clouds.
Yeah. Oh, that is quite the dad activity.
It is the daddest activity. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm wearing my Red Wings jersey here tonight.
Yes.
I've been wearing it most nights that I've been watching hockey, and it seems to be a bit of a good luck charm. But our Wings are angling towards the playoffs, and it's all on the back of Patty Kane and his sort of miraculous comeback season. So.
Yeah, he was at like a point a
game.
Hockey
podcast.
No, but I mean, but we're hockey fans, and I mean, there's he was like at 26 points in 26 games. Now, a question: Are you the type of sports fan to always, like, if you're watching the Tigers, you wear something Tigers, a jersey, shirt, hat, you're wearing watching the Wings, you that kind of guy?
No, maybe football. I definitely like college football, or like I try to for the Lions too, because that's a game a week. You know, we're talking 5-6 games a week for the Tigers. There's no fucking way I can do that. I don't have that many Tigers shirts.
I was going to say, either I don't know what your laundry situation is like in your apartment there. I don't know if you got to go down to a common laundry area.
Yeah.
You can't keep washing the same couple shirts over and over again, you know, for $3.50 a load or whatever they charge you. Fun fact, those keys are easily found on the internet for very cheap. So if you ever want to fuck with your laundry, you live in an apartment. I'm just putting that out there. How superstitious are you as a sports fan?
Pretty.
Okay. Well, I was
pretty
asking.
Superstitious?
Because the previous, prior to meeting the lovely Mrs. Mizell, the woman that I was dating at the time, it was during the 2002 NHL playoffs when the Wings won the cup that year. And the woman that I was with at the time we were watching the Avalanche. It was Red Wings Avalanche. I think it was the Western Conference Finals. And it was a tight game. It was tightly contested. She got up to go to the bathroom, and the Red Wings scored. And so that became a thing where, like, every time they needed a goal, she would go to the bathroom, and it always worked, including the famous triple overtime against the Carolina Hurricanes in the Stanley Cup Finals that year. She went to the bathroom, wasn't even thinking about it, because at that point we'd gone into triple overtime, wasn't even thinking about it. She went into the bathroom. We all went nuts when they scored, and she came out, and she was like, "Did what?" And I'm like, "It worked! You did it again! Your magical bladder!" So that was.
I'm surprised you didn't just keep her in the bathroom. Like, why don't you just stay in there, make yourself comfortable until the game's over?
In retrospect, probably would have been a better course of action considering how that relationship turned out. But, you know, hindsight's 2020. Is that bad? I don't know.
Does she listen? I don't know.
No, I doubt it. I doubt she has any interest in what I'm up to 22 years later. Please continue.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, no. Yeah. I did want to introduce a new segment on the show before we get to the news, and we're calling it Matt's Soapbox. I mean, you can have a soapbox too. This was just a thought that occurred to me this week because
that's fine.
So many people have been complaining that there aren't enough televised spring training games. And I disagree. I don't think that we need every single game of baseball televised, especially when they are exhibition games that don't really count for anything, and they don't really even say that much about how your team's going to perform in the regular season. They're essentially play practices. You're playing another team to just see how your team's shaping up in rehearsal, you know?
Yeah.
I'm never going to complain about more baseball. Like, if it is on TV, I'll watch it. But I also, like, growing up, I don't remember spring training games ever being televised. I don't even remember them being on the radio. And pretty much every game is on the radio now. I would say about a third of them are televised. Yeah. And this isn't even regular season. I mean, every game in the regular season is televised. So it's a weird complaint.
I completely agree with you. I think you are 100% in the right. I get it. I do. You're talking to a guy who plays a ton of MLB The Show, not just because I love the game, but because I just love baseball and I want to, like, inject it into my veins whenever possible. That said, take a look at the spring training schedule and look for, like, there's, like, sometimes games will have SS next to them. That means split squad. Like, there are some games where it's literally like, "Hey, man, are you a Tigers fan? Are you really curious to see what Andre Lipschitz is up to right now? Like, go watch this split squad game where a bunch of guys that wear numbers over 70, you know, a bunch of dudes out there, who's number 74? We don't know. He didn't give him a name. He's not going to be here in 2 weeks anyway. Don't worry about it. It's practice. It's glorified practice. Pitchers are out there just trying. They're just trying to work on new pitches. They're trying to learn a changeup. Hitters are trying to get their timing down and figure out this hitch in their step. It's practice. That's all it is.
Alex Manoah's trying not to hit people and failing.
Exactly. That poor guy. I want to root for him so bad. But anyway, point is, I completely agree with you. I will stand alongside you. I will get my soapbox out and drag it next to your soapbox and stand alongside you. We can hold hands if you want, and I will stand.
Hey, I would love that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not afraid of. I'm not toxically masculine. I don't know what kind of masculine I am.
We are two friends who've known each other for the better part of a decade, and we are not afraid to hold hands and talk about. There's
baseball.
Too much complaining about televised baseball.
What are those two weirdos doing on the street corner, standing on a box, holding hands, yelling about spring training, nerds?
All right, let's get to the baseball news. Of course, last week we talked about uniforms, and there was even more drama that we didn't cover that has developed over the last week because we started playing spring training games. And there was also team photos that players were taking, and many fans started to notice that these new Nike pants are basically sheer. You can see the tucked jerseys or the compression shorts through the pants. And
some testicles.
The testicles. You can see literally their genitals. not good. And MLB claims that the material is unchanged from last year. Now, we covered last week how they are no longer personally tailoring the pants. You have to order them sized, and they're stretchy enough theoretically that they should work. But this is not the same material. This is definitely something different, because I don't ever recall seeing a baseball player's testicles. But also, that fella should, I forget what the player was, but he should probably wear a cup.
Yeah, Casey,
always advocated
Casey Schmidt.
For cups.
Yeah, Casey Schmidt.
Casey, put your cup on, bud.
Yeah, put a dance belt, literally. Literally anything, which is what a dance, I mean, anything. Dance belts are basically jock straps, for those of you who didn't get degrees in theater.
The league also apparently is suffering from a pants shortage. So not only are they terrible pants, but there aren't enough of them. so they've been wearing old pants. I read an article, and the main quote I took away from it was Tony Clark, the MLBPAA president, saying, "The primary concern right now is the pant."
we must deal with the pant.
Free agency, budget restrictions, whatever. We're talking about pants this year.
I can't wait for the 5,000-word Ken Rosenthal think piece on pants.
It was a cold winter day, or a cold April day in Boston when... Chris Sale doesn't play there anymore, does he? I'm trying to think of a player that has his balls out and shriveling in the cold air. And
how about
Rafael? Let's move
Rafael on. Devers. Nope. He's like, nope, we're calling an audible. Move on.
A's fans threw their own fan fest. I thought this would be a cool thing for any team fan base to do. And of course, it is this fan base that has been so maligned over the last year. They drew over 10,000 people, nearly 20,000. And they had former players like Coco Crisp and Trevor May there making appearances, meeting fans. It looked awesome. And it was entirely driven by the fans. I cannot comprehend why somebody would want to abandon a fan base this lovable and this driven to support a team, if only a team would have.
I can't either. And of course, it all comes back around to the bootlickers who say, well, if they'd have supported the team like this before, John Fisher made no efforts to put a team worth rooting for on the field, and people still showed up. You know, I mean, even as recently as a couple years ago when they were in the playoffs, they were averaging like 17 or 18,000 fans a game. I can't remember. It sucks. It just sucks. And we can't belabor the point enough, because it shouldn't be happening. Sell the team. I the only thing I'm holding out hope for, and I actually feel really good about this, is that I'm pretty sure John Fisher is going to fuck this up somehow.
Yeah.
I know he
seems
will.
Like we have a new story every week where it seems like he is.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I can't wait for the next installment.
There was a side story A's adjacent that I wanted to mention, where Trevor May, he was on a podcast or something, but he revealed a gift that the Athletics players were given when the move announcement was made last year. Cheap cowboy boots from The Gap, which is coincidentally a company founded by John Fisher's parents. So Gap,
yeah,
cowboy boots. I like the Gap for, you know, basic clothes. Cowboy boots?
No. Now, I know that when I think of cowboy boots, I think of the Gap, but that's because I haven't been on a horse in 20 years. And even then, I was kind of up on one against my will. So yeah. I think he has a point. It's just peak John Fisher cheap. You know, cheapskate behavior.
It didn't even really occur to me. What the fuck does that have to do with Vegas?
Nothing. He found them in some fucking warehouse in Alameda or something, and was like, "Get 26 of those. 27. Yeah. I want a pair. I want a pair. Give me a pair. These things are great."
Speaking of shitty owners, we talked a little bit recently about how the White Sox want to build a new stadium a little bit closer to downtown Chicago. And the owner, Jerry Reisdorf, is looking for roughly $1.7 billion of public funds, either city or state, lobbying a little heavier for state. Here's a fun fact. Illinois recently elected a pretty cool governor who also happens to be a billionaire, but is a cool billionaire. They're very rare. Governor Pritzker is his name, and he this week pushed back on any kind of chatter about the White Sox stadium as it relates to public funding. And this is a quote from him. The idea of taking taxpayer dollars and subsidizing the building of a stadium does not seem like it should have higher priority. These are private businesses. Let's give it up for him.
That is the exact way everybody should react when one of these shitty owners goes, you know, it'd be a real shame if this baseball team suddenly weren't in this city anymore. That's how they are private enterprises. They are private businesses. They are owned by people who can afford to build that stadium. Take out a loan or just go into your comically large Scrooge McDuckian vault and scoop out a couple billion and build the fucking stadium yourself. Seriously.
I think that you have a particular benefit of talking about a Chicago team, because if you say, oh, we're going to move, you say, where the fuck are you going to go? Like, and if you did, okay, we have another team in town. Bye. Now, granted, the Cubs owners aren't that great either, but like, they also, you know, they have Wrigley. If they were to move, if the White Sox were to move, it would either have to be across the country to a state that would probably be even less tolerable of giving them money, or to the Chicago suburbs, which wouldn't really help anything. You still want that money. So good luck, bud. And I loved the renderings of this new field. I thought the location was awesome. I thought the idea of the field is awesome. And I hate the White Sox, but I think that the whole concept of moving them sounds cool. Same with Kansas City. Kansas City wants a similar huge fucking public investment to put a stadium smack dab downtown. The idea sounds awesome. A new stadium within walking distance of my old apartment. But the idea of taxpayers in this country, when we already give so much tax money that goes to bullshit, we don't need to add on more bullshit.
No, absolutely not. If I remember correctly, I was reading about one of these boondoggles. I think it's Kansas City, like, has the ability to, like, enact, like, a tax on the fans. Like, that. Basically, if you want to tax anybody, tax the people who come into the stadium and actually use the stadium, not, you know, people who have no interest in... I know I read it, but I can't remember which one of these it was in relation to. I can't. But that's how you do it. If you want to do it, put a tax on the tickets, you know, an extra, you know, 1%, 2% surcharge or something, something small. But if you're going to create a tax that is going to place a burden on somebody, place it on the people who are actually using the stadium and not, you know, people that just happen to live in proximity to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that tax could also just be the door charge.
Yeah.
All right. Our final story this week, and this comes from our favorite team, of course, the Detroit Tigers. The Tigers have finally removed a mysterious statue from their spring stadium in Lakeland, Florida, which claimed to be of Detroit legend Ty Cobb. The statue bore no resemblance to Cobb or any reputable Tiger, and is likely a knockoff from Thailand. And they, in this news story I read, it was reported initially by Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic, essentially tracked down that this was a mass-produced baseball statue. And there's little miniatures that have been everywhere. There's, you know, mid-sized ones. This is a human-sized one that somebody just gave to the stadium operator out there in Lakeland. And they said, hey, it's Ty Cobb. He's a Tigers legend. You should put it up at Joker Marchant Stadium. And he's like, it doesn't look like Ty Cobb, but if they say so, okay. It's been there for 3 years. And it has a, it doesn't have anything on the statue that says Ty Cobb. So they added a little sign that says, this is Ty Cobb. And so many people were taking pictures with it, and it was a big selfie moment. But Cody Stavenhagen reported that article 2 years ago saying, who the fuck is this statue of? Because it's not Ty Cobb. Ty Cobb's granddaughter, I think, was like, that's not Ty Cobb. I don't know who the fuck that is. So they finally removed it, I think because some of the Tigers beat writers came back to spring training and said, hey, this fucking statue's still here. What the fuck? And it's finally gone. I have a proposition. Put an actual statue of Ty Cobb there. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple thing. That I think there's lots of pictures of the guy. Hire somebody who actually knows how to make a statue that looks like...
He's one of the best-known baseball players in history. I think it'd be pretty easy.
I would like to think so. Don't they have one in Comerica, I feel like? Do they have statues of a couple players?
I believe he's on the statue park out in the outfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, the outfield wall.
Exactly.
And his, take that one. Just take the bust of that one and bring it down to, to Florida.
There you go. Just put a mold around it, you know, and you know, figure out a way to do that and just take that one down there. They've retired his number, too, but it's like zero. Like, he didn't have a number.
He didn't have a number.
So, you know, just take that. We're not using it. You know, and then bring it back in the spring. It goes with the team. You know, it's make it a trophy or
that.
Something. There you go. Yeah. Sort of like the Paul Bunyan trophy, but it's the Ty Cobb statue. And it's been in Chicago for 5 years now because we keep losing the season series to the White Sox or whatever. I don't know. And then we get a statue of Paul Konerko?
I don't want that.
AJ Pierzynski.
Paul Konerko. Maglio Ordóñez is a great White Sox slash Tiger. How about that?
There you go. I like it. The Ordóñez series
the
every year.
We won the Maglio.
It's got to have the mullet.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Let's move on to our main topic. Take it away, my friend.
Now, we here at Put Me In Coach are well aware that we are now in the throes of that most wonderful annual baseball tradition, spring training, so it might come as a mild shock to hear us talking about free agency right now, which is what we all love to talk slash gripe slash pontificate about during the winter months. But this past offseason was an odd one for free agency, with several high-profile free agents still looking for somewhere to hang their hat. Now, with their inevitable signings looming over us, you know, we just had Bellinger sign, and the memories of an unusual free agency period fresh in our minds, we thought it would be fun to do a deep dive into free agency, because it's something that pretty much every baseball fan is aware of, but not many people know the history of how free agency came to Major League Baseball, or how it dramatically altered the landscape of the game. Now, before we begin, a couple of caveats. One, we're not really going to talk about the mechanics of free agency as it exists right now. As it stands right now, from the time you start accruing service time in the big leagues, you get 6 years. Once you've surpassed 6 years, you can become a free agent. In its simplest terms, that's free agency. The other caveat is it's important to note that this is going to be a rather truncated version of the story of free agency. There are countless resources out there that give glimpses into various skirmishes in the endless war between players and owners, but we are going to focus less on the battles and more on the war big picture. Now, and efforts to unionize baseball players are almost as old as the game itself. The first efforts to unionize occurred in 1885 with the formation of the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players. So quaint, the Brotherhood.
Yeah, I love that. I always appreciate these old-timey baseball union names that separate base and ball in the title. We covered a couple of those in the last couple episodes. Baseball.
Oh, yeah. It's hard. I haven't quite locked in where they brought the two words together, but as recently as 1922, we'll get to why, as recently as 1922, they were still separating those two words. So the formation of the Brotherhood came just 9 years after the founding of the National League and 16 years before the American League arrived on the scene. The efforts to unionize were all in response to the reserve clause. And you're going to hear that phrase so much in this episode, and I'm sorry in advance. But if you're lucky enough to not have this cursed knowledge rattling around in your skull like I do, allow me to rectify that for you. The reserve clause, first enacted in 1879, was created as a means of codifying a previously informal rule called the five-man rule. Essentially, a handshake agreement amongst owners, the rule allowed teams to reserve five men on their teams, but when owners started violating the handshake agreement, the reserve clause became official. With that clause in place, every professional contract now included the reserve clause. The team that held the player's rights was the only team that could sign that player. In modern parlance, every contract was essentially a one-year contract with a club option for the next year. So they could be just renewed in perpetuity forever. And that was it.
Boy.
Yeah. It wasn't great. The only way a player could change teams was to either be traded, sold, or outright released. The owners presented this as a necessity because if the players were allowed to just change teams of their own volition, salaries would skyrocket and the owners simply couldn't afford that. Now, at this early stage, the only recourse a player had was to hold out and hope that their talent could get them their asking price. And as if the reserve clause wasn't bad enough, in 1885, owners also adopted a salary limit of $2,000, equivalent to just over $56,000 in 2022. That limit was ultimately scrapped 2 years later But the owners are always going to own her, and instead, they replaced that firm limit with a soft one, a classification system. Now, the players would be paid according to an arbitrary classification system, ranking them A through E, with the A players considered the best players, and the E players considered the worst. In response, the aforementioned Brotherhood was formed, led by New York Giants player-slash-manager John Montgomery Ward. In their biggest shot at the owners, the Brotherhood formed the Players League in 1890. The league had teams in eight cities, New York, Brooklyn, Buffalo, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. Players were paid the salary they had in 1889 unless they'd been subjected to the classification system. Those players were paid their 1888 salary. Despite games being well attended, the league folded after one season, with the Boston Reds taking home the league's lone championship. Basically, the games were really well attended and business was good, but the owners kind of got cold feet and just weren't sure that the money was going to be there the next year, so they all just kind of folded up tents and shut her down.
I remember that from our Spiders episode, where a big consideration for it was like where they were going to play. And in New York, they built the Polo Grounds, which was this sprawling complex that was huge, and they couldn't fill it, even though they were pretty solidly attended games. But it was sort of like, well, they spent all that money in New York and nobody's showing up, so what do you want the rest of us to do? That's New York.
Yeah. Have you been reading ahead? Because I'm going to talk about that in just a second.
I'm sorry.
In a roundabout way.
No,
I was just fascinated that our minds were in simpatico. Because after the league folded, the teams in Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Brooklyn and New York merged with their National League counterparts, while the Boston and Philadelphia teams joined the American Association, which then folded in 1891. I didn't find anything about where the Cleveland team and who else am I missing there? There was a team in the Buffalo team. I didn't find anything about where those teams went. Something of note that did come out of all of this, though, was the construction of the Polo Grounds, which had been built for the Players League's New York team and was originally known as Brotherhood Park.
Did they ever play any polo there?
I don't think so.
It's just a fun name. Exclusively baseball and football, right?
I'm pretty sure, but goddamn, if I had a time machine, I always say this. Somebody posted on like one of the baseball sibs the other day, like, what's one historic stadium that's no longer standing you could go to? And I would love to see the Baker Bowl in Philadelphia, but it has to be Polo Grounds. It has to be.
Yeah. I live about 40 blocks north of where the Polo Grounds were. And I would love to be able to just walk to a gigantic baseball stadium and see some baseball like that. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
There are no big baseball stadiums in Manhattan now.
No. Now I kind of have a good sense of where exactly you are, because I think a mutual friend of ours, Isaac, lives like right around the, I don't know if you know, I'm not going to say his last name on the show, but he lives like right around the corner from where the stairs are, like like a set of stairs that what Coogan's Bluff that still go down to where the Polo Grounds were. That's all that's left of the Polo Grounds. But back to the story. Business continued as usual in 1915, or business as usual continued as usual until 1915 is what I was trying to say, when the Federal League, founded only 2 years prior in 1913 as a third major league, folded. As the league was scrapped for parts, not all of the Federal League owners were happy with the outcome, most notably the owners of the Baltimore Terrapins. They were not offered any form of compensation, so they decided to sue, and they sued everybody. They sued the National League, they sued the American League, and they sued multiple Federal League officials. The Baltimore Consortium argued that the defendants had conspired to destroy the Federal League and monopolize baseball in America, which, according to their reading of the law, was in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, a fun bit of legislation that was passed in 1890. It was, in its broadest terms, it serves two key functions. One, it prohibits anti-competitive agreements, and two, it prohibits unilateral conduct that monopolizes or attempts to monopolize a relevant market. Baltimore ownership was handed a victory in 1919 when a court decided the defendants were found jointly liable. Their victory was short-lived, though, because a court of appeals said that professional baseball clubs were not subject to the Sherman Antitrust Act. Those case,
motherfuckers.
What? I know, right? Always.
I said those motherfuckers.
Sherman Antitrust Act. Yeah. This case would ultimately make its way to the Supreme Court, and in the landmark 1922 case, Federal Baseball Club v. National League, the Supreme Court sided with professional baseball, claiming that despite the fact that players crossed state lines and people paid actual physical money to see them play baseball, games of baseball were state affairs. That's states' rights argument again. This case is the main reason why Major League Baseball has not faced competition from other leagues since 1922, and they remain the only American sports league with an antitrust exemption.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such an interesting time, too, for the trust busting, as it's called, because the only real rabid trust buster that we'd had ever was Roosevelt, and he came in between the original Sherman Antitrust Act and then business coming back to booming in the 20s and 30s, you know, so he did enough to help the country, but then the businesses came booming back and unbusting made them feel good. Sorry.
Don't be. It was genius. And I love you for it.
I did love, I don't know if this is covered in your script, but I did love that during the lockout a couple years back that Bernie Sanders was threatening to remove that protection for Major League Baseball. I don't know what power the United States Senate has in something like that, but it's a fascinating threat that you can have against the league, I guess. Yeah.
I don't go that far. Spoiler alert, I pretty much stop at the inception of free agency, but I can expand on that extemporaneously beyond that portion. The important portion is here. There was a challenge to Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption with the unionization of the minor league players. I can't remember all the details, but that was sort of a shot across the bow, so to speak. A phrase
that
is,
yeah,
a phrase that is at the forefront of my mind because it's in the next line of my script. No more shots would be fired across baseball's bow until 1947. See, told you. When a former New York Giants outfielder named Danny Gardella sued Giants owner Happy Chandler. Chandler had taken exception to players heading south to play in the Mexican League, so he enacted a 5-year ban on anyone who dared to jump ship. After a Chandler victory was kicked back to circuit courts by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, Chandler ultimately settled with Gardella for $65,000. This case would lead to the formation of a special judiciary committee to look into monopoly power, with baseball not being the central focus, but it was part of a larger conversation. Several players were called to testify, and in the least shocking development imaginable, star players like Lou Boudreau and Pee Wee Reese spoke out in support of the reserve clause. I could not confirm if Boudreau was French for bootlicker or not, but I'm going to go with it. While players like minor league veteran Ross Horning testified the reserve clause severely limited the ability of the rank-and-file players to find spots on big league rosters. And ultimately, it was decided that Congress should take no action and leave it up to the judiciary. Remember this
classic
moment in
Congress.
The show.
Classic
yep. See?
Congress.
You know where this is going.
Work? We don't want to do that.
The next assault on the reserve clause came in 1953 when a pitcher for the New York Yankees named George Toulson sued the big club. Back in 1949, he was assigned to the Yankees' AAA affiliate, the Newark Bears. And Toulson believed that he was good enough to play in the bigs, but he was in the farm system of the extremely talent-rich New York Yankees and just couldn't, you know, break the roster and get his shot. When the Bears were dissolved in 1950, he was assigned to the Binghamton Triplets, which is an A-level affiliate of the Yankees, so he just got dinged like two levels. Toulson refused the assignment and instead filed suit, arguing that the reserve clause was a restraint of trade and therefore was subject to antitrust laws. Now, at the outset, it seemed like there could be cause for hope. Baseball had changed dramatically since the Federal Baseball Club v. National League court case. Baseball was more popular than ever, and with rapidly improving infrastructure, fans not only went to games near their hometowns, but they also hopped into cars and trains and crossed goddamn state lines to engage in the commercial act of giving someone money in exchange for the right to watch a goddamn baseball game. Hell, sometimes they would even enjoy a game taking place in another state in the comfort of their own home by listening to a game on the radio. If it looks like interstate commerce, walks like interstate commerce, and quacks like interstate commerce, it is interstate commerce, right? Wrong. The courts simply reiterated federal... I should have known that was coming. The courts reiterated Federal Baseball Club's finding, adding that it is up to the legislative branch to fix this mess, not the judiciary. So, what we see here is a classic tactic of American government. Blame another branch. Congress didn't do anything in 1951 because they thought the Gardella case in 1948 had settled things, and the Supreme Court didn't do anything in 1953 because if Congress didn't enact legislation, then it must not be a problem. I will now pause for you to go scream into your favorite screaming pillow.
See, the problem here is that we've had one baseball fan president, and he was a goddamn owner, so he wasn't gonna do shit about this.
Oh, God. Don't miss W. Well,
he was also busy with other evil stuff. So.
I know, right? He was too busy being evil war crime committer. Now, this is the part of the story where things really take off, and it would be very easy for me to go all behind the bastards and turn this into a six-part epic episode, but neither Matt nor I have the time or bandwidth to commit to such an endeavor. So, buckle up and get ready for what I hope is the audio equivalent of an action movie training montage. The seeds of what we now know as the Major League Baseball Players Association were planted in 1953, but the MLBPA was not officially recognized as a union until 1966. That same year, they hired Marvin Miller to serve as their executive director, and in his 17-year tenure, players would see salaries, pension funds, licensing rights, and revenues increase. He is widely regarded as one of the most important figures in the history of baseball, even by those who fought against his efforts. There are people who hate Marvin Miller's guts, still alive today, who are like, but God damn it, I respect him. He's that kind of guy.
Classic union leader.
Yeah.
And it always ends up being like, yeah, fuck that guy. But you know what? He was great.
Yeah. And if you really want to feel some feelings, go Google a picture of like Marvin Miller when he was young. And he was so handsome, it might awaken something in you if you haven't already had that awakening. He was a very, very dashing man. He did all kinds of stuff. And one thing that I don't really mention in the script that is worth mentioning because it does come up later in the episode is that one of the major achievements of his early years in the union was the first collective bargaining agreement, which occurred in 1970. Now, at this point, we are likely at a point in the story where a decent chunk of our listeners have some familiarity with the history of free agency, and that would be the historic court case Flood v. Kuhn. For the unfamiliar, here's a brief primer slash another action movie montage kind of thing. From 1958 to 1969, Curt Flood was one of the finest center fielders in all of baseball. In his career, he would be named to three All-Star teams, be a part of two World Series championships, and win seven Gold Gloves. And while he's best known these days as a Cardinal, Flood actually started his career as a Cincinnati Red. And despite impressing their front office with his play, ownership cried poverty and claimed they couldn't possibly afford to increase his salary. This would impress upon Flood that his future in the game of baseball was out of his control. And that would all come to a head in 1969 when the Cardinals traded him to the Philadelphia Phillies. And Flood refused, citing the fact that he did not want to uproot the life that he'd spent 12 years building in St. Louis, including a photography studio. Fun fact, he was a really talented photographer and a really talented artist as well. He even had painted a portrait of the then owner of the Cardinals, Arthur Bush, or August Bush, one of the Bushes. So yeah, he had all that plus a
but
life
not the
that
president.
He built, spent 12. No, B-U-S-C-H, not B-U-S.
Yes.
H. That guy.
Like
right?
The beer.
Exactly. He also expressed reservations about the skinflint, cheap reputation of the Phillies organization and the widely known fact that at that time, Philadelphia sports fans were extremely racist. At the time. I lived in Philadelphia.
Like
I said, I lived in Philadelphia for a couple of years. Like I said, it is a unique town that has earned its reputation, and I'm sure there are a lot of racists in Philadelphia, but there are a lot of racists everywhere, so I don't wish to cast aspersions on
most of them
everybody.
Most of them are Red Sox fans.
There you go. Yeah, Boston there are a lot of racists in Boston. I'm fine with saying that. I don't care. Instead of, let's see here, he opted to retire. He was like, fuck that. I'm not going to Philadelphia. I retire. He actually got the call to be told he was traded as he was preparing to go on vacation to Copenhagen. And he just said, I'm going to retire. He'd been telling St. Louis, if you trade me, I'll retire. He did it. They thought they were kidding. Philadelphia was like, bro, you coming? And he was like, nah, man, I'm in Copenhagen. What do you want? Yeah. So Marvin Miller gave him the full support of the union and offered to fund a legal battle, which would ultimately lead to Flood v. Coon. The Supreme Court would uphold the rulings of the lower courts, once again kicking the can down the road for somebody else to deal with. Now, there, I passed along to you in the script the link to the Wikipedia page for Flood v. Coon. It has a lot of wonderful information in it if you would like to learn more about this case, and I encourage you to do so. Click on that link and check it out. Realizing that the courts were never going to be a viable path to change, the union decided to take a different approach and take advantage of a key feature of the first collective bargaining agreement, which was put place in 1970. Arbitration. Now, we've talked about arbitration on the show before, and this is where it started. Marvin Miller encouraged his players to not sign contracts and instead take their cases in front of an independent arbiter, which at the time they only had. Now they have, I shouldn't say independent. This person back then wasn't an independent arbiter, and I'll get to that in a second. But these days they go in front of an independent arbiter, and I think you're going to kind of see why later on down in the script. The tactic paid off, and it gave us baseball's first free agent, Jim Hunter, better known as Catfish Hunter. Arbitrator Peter Seitz, remember that name, determined that the Oakland Athletics had committed a breach of contract and declared Hunter's contract void, paving the way for Hunter to sign a 5-year, $3.25 million contract with the New York Yankees, making him the first free agent in baseball history.
Good on him. Yeah. What did Oakland do? Did they just, they weren't paying him enough, or?
I didn't see anything about the specific breach of the contract. I couldn't find anything like that. So that's just what happened, is what I'm gonna say. If somebody else wants to do it, they can go do the research and add it to in a comment on social media or something.
Again, it's a fast and loose history here. So
exactly. Again, like I said, we are playing broad strokes. Just 1 year later, the next major blow to the reserve clause was dealt by two players, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally. Now, Dave McNally had retired partway through the 1974 season when he was traded from Baltimore to Montreal and then just said, fuck it, I don't want to go. With the reserve clause in place, if he unretired, he would have to report to the Expos. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, Messersmith was coming off a tremendous 1974 season that saw him lead the National League in wins. He asked not only for a raise, but also for a no-trade clause for his 1975 for the next year's contract. Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley said, hey man, great, you get your raise, but you're not getting a no-trade clause because I think there's rules in place or something. I don't want to look. Being a strong union supporter, McNally joined the fight, and in October of 1975, the players' union filed a grievance on their behalf. The grievance took direct aim at the reserve clause, which was couched in the uniform players' contract of the basic agreement, which stated that, quote, the club shall have the right to renew his contract for the period of 1 year on the same terms. Arbitrator Peter Seitz, told you to remember that name, sided with the players, and literal moments after he sided with the players, the owners fired his ass.
Of course they did.
Yeah.
And I believe you told us there's a reason why he didn't stick around very long.
It's almost like we knew the owners would do something like this. and that really kind of brings it full circle. Free agency would eventually find its way to Major League Baseball with the 1976 collective bargaining agreement. Under that agreement, players who had signed a contract with their team before August 9th of that year would become free agents at the end of the season. The club was allowed to extend their contract for 1 year, at which point the player would enter free agency in 1977. All players who signed contracts after that date would automatically reach free agency after 6 years of major league service. Any player with 5 seasons of service, meanwhile, could demand a trade from the owner and provide a list of teams he did not wish to be traded to. If that player was not moved to an agreeable team by March 15th, he too would become a free agent. And that pretty much kind of wraps up the history of free agency. But as a small postscript, I would like to mention that what we now know as the 10-5 rule, you're familiar with the 10-5 rule, I believe?
You've told me about it before, but I think our listeners would probably benefit from hearing it again.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure you know. I know you know. Any player with at least 10 years of service time, five of which were with the same team, cannot be traded without the player's consent. That clause or that rule was part of the first ever amendment to the 1970 collective bargaining agreement. And when it was first added to the CBA, it was known as the Curt Flood rule.
Hell yeah. Good for Curt Flood.
So there you go. So that is the history of free agency. Now, I'm fairly familiar with sort of like the modern version of free agency. If you're not too familiar with it, the next major free agent adjacent development occurred in the mid to late 80s with collusion. The owners were busted for basically it was determined that they had colluded to suppress the free agent market. The guys like Kirk Gibson didn't get signed, Andre Dawson wasn't getting signed, like some big names at that time were not being offered contracts, and it was because the owners were like, we'll show these fuckers. You know, let's just not sign anybody, and they'll have to come crawling back. And that happened, it's literally like, if you Google it, the incidents that occurred are called Collusion 1 and Collusion 2, Electric Boogaloo. you know, I don't know why they added that. It seems superfluous, but it does kind of roll off the tongue. I think like anytime you have to say something to, you have to say Electric Boogaloo, even if you've never seen it or were born well after that movie came out.
What is that movie?
So it was a couple of movies back when breakdancing was big in the 80s.
Yes.
There was a movie called Breakin', and then there was a movie called Breakin' 2,
Electric Boogaloo. Yes.
I was convinced that I was going to be the next great breakdancer, and I was terrible. I was an uncoordinated little child. but just imagine, look at my son, because he looks exactly like me at that age, and just imagine him trying to convince his older cousins and aunts and uncles that one day he was going to be the next great breakdancer. I wasn't. Spoiler alert, I now co-host two podcasts and am a middle-aged dad of two living in mid-Michigan. I am not the world's next great breakdancer.
To be fair, in your defense, is anybody your age the next great breakdancer? At this point,
no.
Can you name a breakdancer?
No, they're not the next great breakdancer. They're the next great person who tries to breakdance and instead breaks something on their person and has a fun story to tell at parties.
Yeah,
but that ain't it. I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, the modern version of what we have now is free agency. Is what it is. But I think this would be a good point to kind of segue into the finale of the show and talk about, we talked a little bit about last week about whether or not Scott Boras might have overplayed his hand. And that seems to be a pretty broad consensus across the spectrum of people who talk about baseball, because Cody Bellinger had to take what is commonly referred to as a pillow deal. And it's essentially just, you know, a 1-year deal with two club options, kind of like what we just talked about. And it was not the like 6 years and $200 million or 7 years and 210 or whatever he wanted. And then Blake Snell's still sitting out there. Matt Chapman's still sitting out there. Jordan Montgomery's still sitting out there. I think owners have basically realized that they were only ever negotiating against themselves, and they're going to wait.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, to fill some folks in, if you don't know, Scott Boras is a sports agent. He is probably the most gone to agent in the league. He represents the most amount of players, or his agency does at least. And he's sort of infamous for going above and beyond to make sure his players get the biggest and best deals. And that's led to, as far as I think a lot of baseball fans are concerned, a sort of inflated player market where you've got guys like Juan Soto or Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer getting these insane, enormous deals for long periods of time. And I think, like Carl said, we're seeing the blowback of that. We're seeing people now say, okay, we can't keep playing paying every single player on a 40-man roster this insane amount of money and this insane contract length. I mean, what was Shohei's deal is something like 12 years, $300 million, and he's obviously deferring it for a long...
Yeah, 10 years, $700 million.
$700 million, sorry. Yeah. That's an insane amount of money. He's deferring it for a while, but like they still got to pay that. And that's the best baseball player in the game today. There are other players that aren't as good as Shohei Ohtani making a shit ton of money too. So it's hard because as a podcast, as a person, I think we both agree that the laborers deserve the most amount of money. A visit from the NYPD real quick.
A time-honored put me in coach tradition. They're just driving by to show you support, baby. Just
want
to
know. An ambulance today, actually.
Oh, all right. Well, you can go.
Probably doing something important.
Yeah.
I think that's where I stand is sort of like, I want the players to get their worth and I want them to take these fucking billionaires for everything that they are worth. But the unfortunate reality of our world is that billionaires are going to billionaire and they're going to go out of their way to make sure that they don't have to pay as much money for this talent because they also want to build stadiums and acquire other teams and build hotels and casinos and other random shit. So it's hard. I think that like you laid out here, it could be a lot worse. but I also think that there are now more creative ways too, where teams are building from their farm systems. They're trying to home grow talent, and then that also comes with either giving a guy an enormous extension long before he hits the league, like the Tigers just did with Cole Keith, or just sort of throwing whatever you got in the minor league system into the bigs and seeing what works. And if it doesn't, next guy up. You know, either way could work, and it's not signing a star player. So
yeah,
I don't know. Those are my thoughts.
I agree. And you brought up the Colt Keith's contract, and I honestly think that's the future. I think that's the mm-hmm. future of baseball, because now think about it. He is now under team control for at least 6 years. And then I think he's got the extra three. I can't remember if he had 2 years or 3 years extra on top of that. So now if he hits, if he's a hit, if he's a success, the Tigers look like geniuses. If he's not a success, he doesn't have an extremely onerous, burdensome contract. He's done after 6 years, and at sixth year, I think he's making $4-5 million, something like that, mm-hmm. Which in today's game is a relative pittance. But let's say he's 4 years in. 4 years into his contract, and he's still under team control for 2 years. Maybe some of these other guys on the infield come through. Justice Bigby comes through. Jace Jung comes through. Maybe somebody in the system we don't know about comes through. Maybe they make a nice trade and bring a good piece over, and all of a sudden, Colt Keith becomes expendable. Now, all of a sudden, he's got a perfectly reasonable contract that they can move with at least two years of team control with those options on the back end that they could just not pay. So they get a good young player for two cheap years with the potential for a big contract. They already know what the big contract is, so they're already locked in for whatever the Tigers negotiated. You know, like same thing with Jackson Chourio and Corbin Carroll and Ronald Acuna and Ozzie Albies. I think you're going to see teams offering more of these deals in order to try and stave off, you know, the mega deals that everybody's trying to get. I do think the mega deals are going to go the way of the dodo. I don't think eventually you're not going to see salaries continue to rise, because I would never side with a billionaire. But if we're going to keep trying to figure out ways to like say, oh, a one win above replacement is worth X million amount of dollars, and nobody can agree on that. If you're telling me that some people say like one win above replacement is worth $8 million, a two war player is worth $16 million a year, get out of your fucking mind. There's no way that a two war player is worth that much. So something has to change in that dynamic, because teams will start to have problems with roster construction, because even though there's no cap, and there shouldn't be, because again, you're right, labor gets the money. You know, you never paid $150 to go to a game and watch an owner sit at his desk. You're going to watch Aaron Judge hit 450-foot bombs.
That's right.
But I think something does have to change, and I think these contracts, this is going to be the future of the game.
I hope so anyway. I think that there's also a world where, what's the best way to put this? You get a Miguel Cabrera situation. And I mean that in the nicest, most biggest fan of Miguel Cabrera way possible. 3-4 years at the end of his career were onerous and hard. And he was kind of a blight in the lineup, but you had to play him because you were paying the most money on the roster. And I do feel like there's now a world where guys like Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, they're going to give a lot of these teams that same headache in a couple of years. Granted, maybe not. I don't know. Aaron Judge has already dealt with a lot of injuries the last couple of years. Will he be Miguel Cabrera slow in 5 years? Maybe. Maybe not. You truly don't know, and that's sort of the weird factor of this whole conversation.
Yeah.
But it's exciting. Baseball, money. We talked very little about the game itself today.
No, but we talked about a major component, especially, again, I think here at the end, we kind of put a little bow on it because free agency changed the landscape of the game as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
It irrevocably changed the landscape of the game, and it continues to do so. And I think we are now at another, another tipping point, so to speak, where something has to change. Like, you know, if you think about it in terms of like branching timelines, like we are at an inflection point, and it's going to go one of, you know, multiple ways. Are we going to see contracts continue to soar, and our team's going to start to actually fold because they actually can't afford to stay in business because the guy, right, who owns the team is only worth $700 million and not $6 billion or whatever. You know, is that going to happen? Are owners just going to say, no, enough is enough? Will we get a cap? You know, anything could happen. And I think right now we are seeing the genesis of an inflection point as it pertains to the future of baseball and free agency, because I think teams are going to move away from trying to build their team through free agency. And you're going to start to see more and more teams try to build strictly in-house, because it's much cheaper for them to dump a bunch of money into TrackMan and Rapsodo and all this technology and develop and develop and develop, and hopefully you hit on a homegrown player. It's way easier and way cheaper to do that than to go out and give Aaron Judge $40 million a year.
Yeah. Final question before we go. Do you think reigning Cy Young winner Blake Snell will have a contract by our next episode?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't.
By opening day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he's going to be somewhere in like, I'm going to say the point is St. Patrick's Day. Somewhere in there. He's already got access to all the best training facilities possible. He doesn't need to be at spring training. But yeah, I think I get the sense that of everybody who's left in the Boris squad, I'm guessing that I just get a sense about Blake Snell being the most pigheaded of the bunch and really trying to push that market. But I think this is what I will say. I don't know when he's going to sign. I think it's going to be closer to the start of the regular season, but I think that we are all going to have a good hearty laugh at the contract that he ultimately gets, because it's going to be so wildly different than what everybody predicted he would get.
I think that, like we mentioned last week, Verlander, the reigning Cy Young last year, signing the biggest pitcher contract in history and just totally eating shit, and then getting traded at the deadline by that same team that signed him for the biggest pitcher contract in history scared the shit out of a lot of people. And yeah, I think if Blake Snell's looking for that number, a guy that, you know, comparing himself to Justin Verlander, who, yeah, won a Cy Young, had a great season with it, Houston before he did that, is probably going to go to the Hall of Fame. No, most definitely going to go to the Hall of Fame. I don't know if Blake Snell really compares to that, even though he did win the Cy last year. It wasn't a pretty Cy. It was sort of a, I guess we got to give it to Blake Snell, but you got to remember, yeah, Astros also won, yeah, the World Series that year, so.
Yeah. He is the softest two-time Cy Young. And I don't mean soft, like he's not a soft person. I'm not besmirching the good name. I just mean like in terms of like, you know, it just doesn't feel like that guy. It's kind of like the Arrested,
yeah,
Development.
Yeah, exactly.
Her? Him?
Yeah.
This guy? Are you sure? All right. Two-time Cy Young. All right. Hasn't pitched over 180 innings ever? That guy? Okay. Yeah. I guess we're hard up for Cy Young winners.
I always said him and Musgrove look like a pair of guys that would sell you wet cigarettes behind a gas station. There's just something about him and Joe Musgrove that just look crusty. And the Padres had all the crusty guys on their rotation last year.
And imagine if he had... Did they overlap with Mike Clevenger with the Padres? Because imagine those three.
Yeah.
There you go. Those guys are sitting. Those three look like dudes that would get cast in a 1980s-based teen comedy where they're selling drugs under the bleachers.
Yeah. Should have been for the Pirates. All right. We've been riffing enough. Folks, we're on YouTube now. Please watch us. We're trying to look pretty for the camera. But if you want to do that, it's put me in _ Pod on YouTube, and we'll have a link in the description. Otherwise, of course, we're on your favorite podcast platform. If you would be so kind, give us some sort of subscription, some sort of review or rating if that's available. Spotify also has a Q&A section. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you've got ideas of stuff we could cover. And next week, I don't know. What do you want to talk about, Carl? Because I think Kirk Gibson could make for a good topic as a good addendum to this story we've told today.
Yeah, because
not
that's
to do a
great,
production meeting on the show, but
no, it's fine. I've got a great Kirk. I've got a great Kirk Gibson story to tell. So let's just go with it.
All right, and if you don't hear that story from us, pretend I didn't say anything. All right, but that'll do it for us. Thanks for listening. This has been Put Me in Coach.
Put Me in Coach is an Arctic Sounds original podcast hosted by Matt Coggins and Carl Mizell. Theme music is by Quack Quack Seatback. Edited and produced by Matt Coggins. Check out the footnotes of this episode to see links to all the great highlights, articles, and sources we mentioned on the podcast today, as well as the full theme song and ways to get in touch with us. For more, find us on Twitter and Instagram at PutMeInPod or at our website, PutMeInCoachPod.com.